Good morning. Welcome. It's Ask the Pastor on the Messenger of Good News Worldwide, KFUO. KFUO is a broadcast ministry of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. I'm Roland Lebner. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Istanbul was Constantinople. Now it's Istanbul, not Constantinople. Been a long time gone. Constantinople, now it's church delight on a moonlit night. Every gal in Constantinople lives in Istanbul, not Constantinople. So if you've a date in Constantinople, she'll be waiting in Istanbul.
Oh, more delightful than any seasonal music I can come up with at this time of year. That theme heralds the arrival of our dear friend, the Reverend Dr. Martin Nolan, who serves as the resident historian here at not only the Bible study, but also Studio A. Blessed Advent, and I guess a little bit early, Merry Christmas, my friend. How are you?
Merry Christmas to you. I'm doing very good. A little chilly here in Evansville, but we didn't get hit with the snow everybody else did, so we're doing fine.
You know, it almost seemed, I was talking with, we were working a little bit late here last night, Gary Duncan and I, and we were just chatting across the hall and said, I walked out of the door yesterday morning from my house to go to work, and it was 55 degrees.
Yeah.
And I walked out the door to go home, and it was 20 degrees. And it did seem like the end of the world. But that's St. Louis for you. Well, are you surprised you're still here?
No, I'm not surprised.
Good. Oh, boy, I tell you, all those folks that spent all that money flying to the Bergerac Mountains.
Now, where is that? Is that in France?
It's in the Pyrenees somewhere.
Oh, really? Now, why did they think that that would be exempt?
There is some folklore that that is an alien landing zone.
Really?
Yeah, they honestly believe that the mountains there house some sort of a garage, maybe a carport, for the alien craft.
Does that have anything to do with the Basques that used to live there?
I don't know. I don't know. They're an interesting people if you study the Basques.
Yeah, well, what was that? Heaven's Gate? Was that group, 10, 15 years ago?
Yeah, Applewhite or something his name. And
yeah,
then,
and if you look at the history of that group, I mean, they're connected to a lot of, well, I don't know what to call it, esoteric or New Age thinking. So,
yeah, science fiction cult type
yeah,
things.
Yeah, they're really, it was more than just that group. There's a lot of people that kind of believe that this stuff is real, so I don't know. Only thing I know is that when I look at the weather map in USA Today now, Roswell, New Mexico is on there.
That's right.
So they're the wrong country.
Yeah, and if you're worried about what's going on there, look at Google Maps. You can actually see it.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, it's on there. Mm. Yeah, well, you know, the mysteries of life, they are dwindling and fleeting. And, hey, I noticed this. I wanted to start you out with something about Martin Luther and Christmas, but I heard the news at the top of the hour, you may have caught it, that two things were said that had some theological content I'd like to get your comment on. They were talking about the memorial for the 20 children that were killed in Connecticut in the shooting 1 week ago today, and the reporter made the statement, the skies were weeping for these 20 children. Why is it when we have real words of comfort we prefer this schmaltzy kind of stuff?
Well, I think journalists are at a loss to know what to say. In the public, you know, when you're in church, the pastor has a defined set of a public. You know, that in a Lutheran church, they've all presumably have gone through the small catechism, and you're speaking to the choir, as it were. So you can say certain things about the deceased that everybody agrees with, and nobody will take offense. And the last thing you want to do in a discussion of, in a memorial, you don't want to cause offense. You want to try to give some comfort. Now, the problem the journalist has is the same that the politician has, is what can he or she say that's going to be of some comfort? And for those that don't believe in the afterlife, and I believe most atheists or agnostics or maybe even unaffiliated, whatever they call that today in journalism, what type of hope is there? I mean, there really isn't any. And so all they can do is cry. And so I can understand why the journalist would say that, because there's no comfort that they can give to that group of people at all. Whereas those that do have a religion and believe in the afterlife, then they can always give that hope, and they should. And if they don't, they're failing in their job.
The other one was the Pope making reference to homosexuality, and the statement that I wrote down very quickly was that people are forsaking their God-given identity And it's absurd because they're doing it simply to suit their own personal choices. And I thought, well, nice to hear some firm words coming out of the Vatican about this.
Yeah, well, the current Pope had a reputation for being a bull in a china shop. He was chosen by John Paul II personally for the position of the enforcer of doctrine, and he was. And although he, you know, he realizes that in the position that he's in now, the Pope has to do many things. He has to wear many different hats. That was a joke. three at least. There's a small joke there. But anyway, he does have to appeal to a wide variety of people. He's expected to be a pastor. And in today's global community, you know, what was it? The Pope just did a Twitter? Is that correct?
Yeah, he just joined Twitter, yeah.
My gosh.
I think he's coming to regret it because most of the stuff that's coming back at him is not very cordial.
Yeah, I would expect. I mean, he has to realize, when you enter into that culture, you've got an entirely different crowd.
Oh, yes.
Anyway, the Pope is expected to be a pastor and to speak words of comfort, as any pastor is expected to do. But then he also has, you know, responsibility for holding the line on the doctrine of the Church. And so whenever he does hold the line on the doctrine of the Church, he also has to do it in a pastoral way as best as he can. And I thought it was not surprising that he said that. I thought he did actually a very good job. And I think we find for example, in the issue of the HHS mandate with regard to contraception and the abortifacient pills, the Missouri Synod and other conservative church bodies, which normally would not be seated at the same desk with the Roman Catholics, they were, and they're fighting on the same issue. So I think you'll find that at various times in history that we have common cause. And so I appreciate what the Pope said, and I'm sure many Christians around the world appreciate what he said, too.
Are you ready to talk a little Christmas?
Go ahead.
It's, well, you know, it's not quite... I've really been harping on this, not to be a curmudgeon, but, you know, it isn't Christmas time yet. That comes Monday at, sundown is officially the launch of Christmas in the church, yes?
That's correct.
Okay. We're still in Advent, but it's okay. We're going to talk a little Christmas. You can't avoid it. It's everywhere right now. But I thought maybe we'd go back to Luther and what Luther thought about Christmas if he would have been, for all this schmaltzy, sentimental, hokey-finokey tinsel stuff. Or what was his view on Christmas?
Schmaltz?
Schmaltz.
Schmaltz at Christmas time? Come on, are you a Grinch rolling?
I've been accused of that, yes.
Scrooge?
Yes, yes. Well, you know, see, I'm the guy that wears purple during Advent.
Purple?
Yeah, well, it's like Lent for me.
Oh, well, I only wear purple because I don't have a blue stole, so what can I do? We don't have blue vestments here.
Well, plus it was the most recent color shirt that they gave us for KFUO, so I'm stuck with it.
Those are nice shirts, by the way.
Yes.
I still have mine.
Good.
But yeah, so what's Luther's attitude toward Christmas, and does Schmaltz include? Well, the first thing you have to realize is that Luther was, of course, a theologian, and that's his main job. He was a professor of Bible history, Hebrew was part of his responsibility. So he really knew the Old Testament very well, and also the New. And if you look at the shelves, if you have all of Luther's works, I think that his biblical commentaries take up more space on the shelf than the other writings, at least in the English edition. So he comes at the issue of Christmas as a biblical theologian. And what that means is, well, let's put aside the myth and the merrymaking and all the schmaltz and just look at it as, what does the Bible say? And he may have been the first in his generation to really do that and to be successful at it, I mean, as a theologian. There were others that had done that, certainly before, but, you know, the preacher would often get off the tangent, and there was often a tendency in preaching on this subject to just embellish it with the legends that were there. There's a English edition of the Golden Legend. It's in two volumes. I don't remember the publisher. And off and on, you can find it at major bookstores. The Golden Legend is a collection of all the major legends of the saints, and these were published. In fact, I think they were actually printed at the time of Luther, because you know the Gutenberg press wasn't that old at the time that Luther was around. So often when you had saints' days or holidays, the preachers would delve into those legends, and that's what they would preach on. Luther, being a biblical theologian, he put that aside and said, what does the Bible say? Let's not look at the myths and the legends that have accreted over the years. Let's not even try to do historical criticism on them. That's for the scholars. Just what does the Bible say about this story of Christmas? So that's his attitude. He wants to know, what does the Scripture say, particularly Matthew and Luke, because they're the ones that give us the most details, and what does this mean? That's a question, you know, he often asks in the Small Catechism, because you have the history of the Christmas story, which is simply the facts of what happened. But then the second question is, what does this mean theologically? How does that story fit into the Old Testament prophecies and the expectation of the people of God? And then finally, how does that apply to us today? And so all these things is what you would find in Luther's sermons and his comments on the Christmas story.
There's a delightful, a couple books. You know, first, I should probably disclaim it by saying anytime I find another guy named Roland who does well, it's going to catch my attention. But there's a fellow out there named Roland Bainton who has written about Martin Luther, and he's condensed two little books that are kind of cool. One is Luther's little Christmas book, and the other one is the Easter book, and it's a compilation topically of some of Martin Luther's sermons. And the Christmas one especially gives you some insight, I think, into the personality of Luther and how he preached. Well, I mean, for example, when he talks about the Annunciation, you know a little bit better about this than I do. Tell me what you think about these books.
Well, I have the. Are you talking about Luther's or the Bainton book?
The Bainton book, and then how he took. You know, when you look at the way he excerpts out the portions of the sermons that he puts in there, what does that tell you about Luther and the way he preached?
Well, we'll first talk about Bainton. I have two versions of what you're talking about, and let's see. The first one was published by Fortress Press in Philadelphia.
Yeah, that's one I have, yeah.
Don't know the year on it. And then the other one was published by, Augsburg in Minneapolis. And they don't exactly have the same stuff in them. So there was a merger of Fortress and Augsburg. So you could do some historical criticism about which thing belongs where. But Bainton, as maybe our readers don't know, published the most popular biography of Luther in the English language, certainly in the 20th century. College students at Lutheran colleges, even seminary students, would read his biography of Luther that was called Here I Stand. And it's available, I think it's still available today, in small paperback. It's the cheapest way to get into Luther and understand his story. So this is who Roland Bainton is. He was Titus Professor of Church History, I believe, at Yale University for his later career. Bainton was a Baptist, but he had great appreciation for Luther, as most Baptists do. And in this book, he tries to pull together a number of materials out of Luther's sermons. At least that's where I understand he's getting the material. And the contents that I have in this one is organized by the topic. Annunciation, that's when Gabriel appeared to Mary. Visitation, which is when Mary visited Elizabeth, and that's in most churches will be having that as the gospel this Sunday. Nativity, that's the birth of Jesus. Shepherds, that would be the angels appearing to shepherds and the wise men. Herod, and then the wise men. Presentation, which is the presentation of the Christ child in the temple with Simeon and Anna. And then the last thing is From Heaven on High, which is the Christmas hymn that Luther wrote. So that's the content of Luther's Christmas book, and as you said, it's a good introduction to Luther's sermons. I also should mention that Luther's sermons, the ones that I use in preparing, are in the Baker Bookhouse editions. They're very reasonably priced, and if your pastor doesn't have these, it would be a good Christmas gift. One is titled The Sermons of Martin Luther, edited by John Lenker. That's a red cover, and then the other, and that is the Church Postles, or the sermons designed for the church. And then the blue-covered one, three volumes, are called The Sermons of Martin Luther, The House Postles, edited by one of my professors, Eugene Klug, also by Baker. And these volumes have the sermons of Luther that were designed by him for use by pastors and by fathers of the house. I actually find, usually whenever I'm trying to prepare a sermon, I go to the blue books, that is the sermons designed for the father of the house, because they're easier to get through and I can get the whole content. And then if I have time, I go into the red books. There's also, Luther's works have some volumes of Christmas sermons in volume 52 and volume 58, which was just released. So these are the sources in English that we have, and that's what, as far as I know, what Baynton is pulling from. The material there is, as I said, Luther is trying to explain what the Bible says, and a person of the day who hadn't heard Luther or a Lutheran preacher before would say, well, what happened to that story about, St. Monica? Or, well, that's actually anachronistic. Monica is from the period of Augustine. But, all these other saints and all these other stories and the cherry tree bending down and all, it wouldn't be in Luther's sermon. They said, well, what happened to that? What's he trying to do?
Yeah.
And then Luther would say, after the service, to the person who's complaining, said, that's not in the Bible. Find that in the Bible, and I'll put it in my sermon. So that's the first thing that you notice about Luther that's different. And the second thing is that I've noticed, and I've read through all these sermons in my career as a preacher, he really makes a very big deal in the sermons about Mary and the sermons about Christmas, about the poverty and the hardship, and you really have pity on Mary and Joseph. It's like they are just at the bottom of the rung of the ladders of society. And one thing I remember, and it'll be in my sermon probably on Christmas Eve, is that Mary and Joseph go to Bethlehem and try to get a place to stay. Everybody can see she's ready to have a baby, okay? And so anytime you see a woman with a child and she's trying to struggle to get into Aldi's grocery store, you hold the door for her. You help her get a cart, and because it's not comfortable and she needs help. Well, so why didn't the people of Bethlehem do this for Mary? Maybe they didn't have an advance reservation at the inn, but somebody should have given, some single man should have given up his little room so she could have had a bed in which to give birth. But no, nobody's willing to give up their room. And in fact, probably the way hotels worked in those days was the people that had money. If you had money, you could say, I got a room. Well, too bad. Now the guy with more money, because it's kind of going on auction now, because everybody needs a room. So because Joseph doesn't have a whole lot of cash, he gets the bottom of the barrel, which is with all the animals. And boy, does it smell in there. Hasn't been cleaned out for a half year. And it's not a clean place. And they feel rejected and forlorn. Furthermore, just think about the fact that, and I'm speaking as Luther does here, why does Joseph and Mary go to Bethlehem? They have relatives there. Why don't any of their relatives put them up? Yeah, now you really feel kind of forlorn and forsaken. Nobody wants me. And here I am, I'm forced to have to go to this town, and I'm losing, I'm a day laborer. I'm losing the pay that I get because I have to come down because of this stupid tax thing from Caesar, and my wife has to give birth in a stable, and boy, do I feel rotten. And my first child with Mary, you know, it wasn't exactly the best circumstances anyway. And here, God gives the gift of a child who is going to save us all. And in the midst of the worst type of circumstances that most of us can imagine, you just feel totally, you know, this isn't how it's supposed to be. And that's the type of narrative that you find Luther talking about in his Christmas sermons. He really wants you to make you feel how Mary and Joseph felt about it. And he does it purely on the, he doesn't add legends, he just kind of does it psychologically. What would you do if you were in that situation? How would you feel about it? And then putting on that side the whole human side of dejection and poverty and meanness, and on that is the fact that Elizabeth says, you are blessed. And to be blessed by God means you're higher than royalty. Now, isn't that a paradox? And this is what Luther plays off constantly in his Christmas sermons, is that amidst this poverty and dejection and feeling everything's going wrong, God has come down and God is with you, and Mary and Joseph are suddenly royalty. And people around the world in 2012 A.D., have little statues of Mary and Joseph in their homes. You know, we don't have little statues of Einstein, maybe bobblehead Einstein, but not little statues that people respect and they wrap up carefully and put it away for the next year and then they pass it on to their kids. Here are two people that are just totally forlorn and poor, and yet God makes them the royalty, the royal family of the earth. And this is how Luther talks in his sermons, and they're great sermons, so I highly recommend that you read them.
The one about the Annunciation that jumped out at me was his take on Mary, and he says her name was Mary. I think she was probably an orphan. Of course, we hear the legend that her father was Joachim, her mother was Anna, and they were wealthy, but there's not a word about that in biblical account. I think she was probably an orphan girl of about 13 years old, and that she was entrusted to Joseph for custody. Well, that's not something that the sort of the narrative of the day goes by, but that does that change how we, well, got to be careful how I ask because I don't want to go and over psychologize it, but excuse me, there's a charm in this that I think is woefully lacking today in how we talk about Scripture.
Meaning?
Well, I don't know that we take the time, as you were pointing out, to really think about who these people are and what
right.
they had to endure. And the way he does it in this, sort of this very practical Luther way, you know, shame on you, wretched Bethlehem, you should have burned with brimstone.
Right, exactly.
I don't know the last time I heard someone preach like that.
Yeah, you don't want to do that right now with the Iron Dome that's protecting, you know, with Gaza missiles pointed that way. You don't really want to say that and give those Hamas people any ideas,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah, you know, another line is, you know, God is amazing. He sends a little baby weak as an earthworm lying in the feed box of a donkey, and that little baby crunches the devil's back and overcomes the power of hell, sin and death. Now, there's a perspective that I think that's why, you know, like I said, not wanting to be the Grinch, but it's been a little bit more in the purple time of Advent,
mm-hmm.
focusing on that, because what I've tried to teach my kids is to see Easter and Christmas, that we really are welcoming the Paschal Lamb that's being born.
Of course, yeah.
And then you know what happens to the Paschal Lamb? You don't put him in a petting zoo.
It's Charlotte's Web all over again.
Yeah, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. The email is up and running, kfuo@kfuo.org. The Reverend Dr. Martin Nolan is our guest this morning on Ask the Pastor. Join us. It's the last live edition of Ask the Pastor for 2012. We're going to be back after these few short announcements. Stick around. Welcome back to Ask the Pastor on the Messenger of Good News Worldwide, KFUO. Our guest this morning is the Reverend Dr. Martin Noland. He serves as pastor at Trinity Lutheran Church, which is in Evansville, Indiana. And if I seem a little bit scattered there at the end, Dr. Noland, I apologize. It's impossible to have a coughing fit on the radio and have a conversation at the same time.
Well, I couldn't tell you were coughing.
Well, see, as a semi-professional radio guy, I've learned how to mask those sort of things. But thank you for your patience. I didn't mean to leave you hanging on some of those questions, not knowing where I was going with them. Hey, have you noticed, I don't know if you're a fan of Fox News. Some folks watch the Fox News channel. Have you noticed that Bill O'Reilly has been losing his mind over this war on Christmas business?
Oh, really? No, I haven't.
Oh, he's been doing a lot of segments about this, and I thought, well, as a pastor, you know, you're probably one of the targets of the war on Christmas. So what do you think? Is there a war on Christmas right now?
Well, when people say duck, I look for crackers.
You're prime today, man. You're ready for the Christmas holiday. We should save you for New Year's. Are you doing anything New Year's Eve?
No, actually, we have friends over, I think. I'd invite you over. We still live in St. Louis, but
yeah,
that's a long drive.
Well, if you were available, maybe somebody would want to book you for a party or something.
I'm not very good at stand-up comedy, just on occasion. But what were we talking about?
The war on Christmas. O'Reilly's been, you know, bringing on the atheists and yelling at them, and people that want to take creches out of the public square and that sort of thing. And well, you know, the whole idea that department stores don't let their employees say Merry Christmas. You have to say Happy Holidays or say nothing at all.
Well, I thought about this for many years, and of course, children run into it right away. You know, they all think, well, what's the big deal? You know. Christmas is time to get presents. You know, why is everybody fighting about this? But I grew up in California, and it's kind of a different culture out there.
Far out, man.
Yeah, and when I went my first year to college at Concordia, River Forest, they all told me that I was from the fruits and nuts. And I said, well, there's some truth to that, because we used to have orchards, and my backyard has my parents' backyard has a walnut tree, which we would shake in the fall and dry out the walnuts and crack them and then put them into Christmas cookies. So, I mean, that's part, you know, fruits and nuts are part of my Christmas memories, too. But, I don't know. To me, I don't know why people get upset about it. We live in a pluralistic country, and we have to respect other people's religions. And the fact is that there are people that, the Jewish people in particular, when they think of the word Christ or Messiah, they don't think of Jesus. And so, maybe they might get upset about that. So you try to avoid upsetting people. I mean, I think that's generally a good rule of thumb. And maybe some companies go overboard with that, I don't know. But it's more than just a holiday, though. And the question is, why do we have it this time of year? Well, it's because of it goes way back to the early Christmas celebrations of the Christian church, and we still have a large majority of population. I mean, you compare the population of Christians in Europe and in America, and that's North and South America, to the rest of the world. I mean, we are definitely a majority population. You know, if you would celebrate Christmas in, let's say, Thailand, you would definitely be in a minority position. So, I mean, I would be surprised if it was a national holiday in Thailand to celebrate Christmas. But here in the United States, Christians are a majority, and so it just makes sense. I mean, we're going to celebrate it whether or not we take the day off officially nationally, or whether the White House has a Christmas tree, whether or not the stores have any Christmas decorations or not. Well, actually, the truth of this is that the stores make a lot of money off of Christians, so why are they giving us a hard time? You have to think about that one.
Yeah.
I mean, it's our holiday, so why are they giving us a hard time? I don't know. I don't understand that, but you know, people are people, and you try to avoid causing trouble, and
well,
at least I do.
Yeah, there's a bit of cognitive dissonance there when you decorate your stores, but then you won't let your employees say Merry Christmas.
Yeah.
You know, you're not decorating it for any other reason.
Right. And I mean, I think that anytime somebody, you know, if I was a Hindu and a devout one, and somebody wished me Merry Christmas, I would understand that as being a wishing of goodwill. And, you know, and they don't know me, so they're not intending to insult me. You know, so I think that's kind of the tolerant, open way that we should live in general. We try not to insult people, and if they are insulted, well, then we should apologize and move on. I mean, this actually goes back. It's interesting, though. I recently published a short article on the first Christmas tree in a church, and there's some debate about that. Actually, I think that the first president of the Wisconsin Synod, the Lutheran Wisconsin Synod, has the claim to putting the first Christmas tree in a church in the United States. But the one that most people know about is the one that happened in Cleveland, Ohio. And that was done by the pastor that would become the third president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. So I have a advice to President Harrison, who works in St. Louis, that he needs to put up a Christmas tree in a church that doesn't have one, so he can make sure that he's reelected. A little bit of a joke there.
Well, on that point, let's go to Herman, because Herman has something interesting that folks may want to take a look at on the web. Herman, good morning.
Go ahead. Yes, thank you, Dr. Nolan. Exactly what you just mentioned there, that there in 1956, that there was about a half-hour TV program made on the Henry Schwann Christmas tree episode that took place 1851 at Zion Evangelical Lutheran Church at Cleveland, Ohio, and that can be accessed through the Internet worldwide now. It's apparently only become recently available, but that's quite a resource to be able to access, and I'm glad you led into that, and I think that's be a very appropriate for this right this time, the last live Ask the Pastor for the year and everything, and the Christmas season just ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Herman. He's talking about, it's called Internet Archive, and you have to go for the title, Our First Christmas Tree. That's the name of the TV program, which was done in 1956, but it refers back to the event in 1851 when Pastor Henry Schwann, not related to the Schwann ice cream trucks, not the elite, maybe he is, I don't know, but Schwann was the pastor at Zion Lutheran Church in downtown Cleveland, not far from the present City Hall, and he'd recently come from St. Louis, which was his first pastor position in the United States. He was pastor at Salem Blackjack. And my kids used to talk about Salem Blackjack because they used to play basketball against them, Salem Lutheran Church and Blackjack. He was their pastor, and he went from there to Cleveland. And when he came to Cleveland, he decided that on Christmas he was going to put up a Christmas tree with the proper decorations. And guess what? The people didn't like it. Some people in his congregation questioned it, and it turned out to be a great conflict. The editor of the newspaper, I believe it was called the Cleveland Leader, called it asinine. So we're talking about conflict about Christmas.
Now that's a war on Christmas.
Well, yeah, and there was, and not only that, but the editor recommended that anybody that was a member of that church should be fired by their employees for having such asinine ideas, as if the Missouri Synod was some type of cult. Well, it turns out that the reason for this is that Cleveland and the surrounding area was founded by people that had come from New England. It was under what was called the Western Reserve. It was property of the state of Connecticut, unlike the rest of the Northwest Territory. And so it was settled by people of strict Calvinist, Puritan background. And their understanding of Christmas was very sober. They did not believe in festivities. They didn't do Christmas trees. And so when some German pastor, because Schwann had immigrated from Germany, comes in and puts one of these things with a creche scene, which they, from the Puritan perspective, that was Roman Catholic, with a creche scene at the bottom, oh, that was just too much. And the editor of the newspaper called, and that congregation put up with this for quite some time. And this, Our First Christmas Tree, it depicts that drama very well. And so you look at that TV program that was done in 56, and you say, things have not changed in 150 years. They're still fighting over Christmas trees.
It does give perspective. It does give perspective. You know, one thing that I can claim a little bit of historical connection to is my mother's people are from Riga, Latvia.
Oh, really? That's where it got started, I think.
Well, it is, and very few people understand that, because really the first public display of the Christmas tree was in 1510, right there in front of the Hall of the Blackheads, which was built back in the 14th century, which is sort of the rot house for them. And it's one of those things where we sort of associate the tree with Luther, but there's a broader, you know, richer history along with it. Though, quite honestly, the Latvians probably pulled a lot of these things out of their pagan heritage as well and applied them to their Christmas celebrations, which is, I think, why most people in Europe took to these things like a Yule log and easily converted them over to use in the Christian church, in the Christian year.
Yeah, and I'm not an expert in all. I mean, usually this comes up seasonally about, you know, where did these things start, and you can probably find fairly accurate information on most of these questions, you know, including what you just said about Riga, Latvia, just by going to Wikipedia and typing in, like, Yule log, and then it'll explain what it is and the history and the origin of it. And it's usually pretty accurate.
You know, and then a couple of doors up from the House of the Blackheads is St. Peter's Church, or the Cathedral of Riga, the Lutheran Cathedral. And, of course, you know who's out in front of that. It's a statue of my namesake.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I don't know why the Latvians have an affinity for this French guy, but they do.
You mean the song of Roland Roland?
Yeah, exactly.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, that goes back to the... wasn't Riga settled by the Teutonic Knights?
Yeah, the Hanseatic League. It was part of that, yeah.
Yeah, I think there's some connection that way.
Yes.
So, are you a Teutonic Knight? Come on, you've been hiding this from all these years.
Well, I don't know. I could use a dollar or two. I might be more prone to go with the Templars. They live better.
Oh. You mean, like, as in, what was the name of Dan Brown's book?
That silly thing.
That silly thing. So, yeah, you're connected to Dan Brown.
No. Let's not. Hey, you know how rumors spread. Don't do that. Not before Christmas.
Knights Templars.
My children will be like Mary, hungry and shoeless in the streets.
Of the Knights Templars, boy, oh boy. That explains a lot about you, Roland.
That's the thing about, and I speak very dearly of my heritage, especially on the Latvian side, but... You know, as fond and as protective of, as they are of their culture, a lot of them really are just sort of transplanted Germans. That really is that's the line that my mother comes from, is more of a transplanted German from the Hanseatic days.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. But history, we have fun with this, Dr. Nolan, because you and I both love history. And you know, you start scratching the surface of one thing and it leads you to so many other places and the things that you would never expect to find. I don't know why we can't. I have a hard time translating this, even to my own kids, why they should have a love of this stuff. But I guess you just have to be sort of, I don't know, maybe a history geek.
Well, someday it hits you, you know, at different times of life. And it's kind of, in that way, it's kind of like religion, too. You know, some people don't get religion until they're very, very much along in years.
No, that's true. That's true.
So it sometimes just takes a certain experience. I want to get back to the Annunciation. The Visitation, because that Sunday's sermon, Sunday's Gospel anyway, most pastors will be thinking about it. I don't know if they'll preach on it. I want to read something from the Martin Luther's Christmas book that Roland Baton edited, and you talked about at the beginning of the program. And I think he really gets this right, because remember, Luther grew up as a medieval Catholic, and he became a very pious monk. And he understood all that. He was a very good monk. He would say he followed it to the letter. And this is what he says about Mary after he explains the Magnificat, where Mary talks about, she sings about the blessing that she is going to be giving birth to a God's son. And this is what Luther says. They do Mary wrong who say that she gloried not in her virginity but in her humility. Luther says she gloried neither in her virginity nor in her humility but solely in God's gracious regard for her. The stress should not be on the low estate, but on the word regarded. Her low estate is not to be appraised, but God's regard, as when a prince gives his hand to a beggar. The meanness of the beggar is not to be praised, but the graciousness and goodness of the prince. The evil eye looks only on the reward and the result of humility. The genuinely humble look not at the outcome of their humility. True humility does not know that it is humble. If it did, it would be proud from the contemplation of so fine a virtue. Now, that takes somebody that's been inside the system of the monastic discipline, where humility was a virtue, and boy, am I proud that I'm humble.
That's right.
I remember my first year in college, I don't remember, maybe I was more pious than I should have been. My first year of college, one of my friends came up to me and said, Martin, aren't you glad that you're so humble? Aren't you so proud that you're so humble? And I thought, ooh, he got me there.
Well, on that point, let's show a little humility and go to the phones,
okay,
because we have some calls who've been waiting for you. Let's go to Jan first. Grab your Bible and take a look at Mark 7:8 and Matthew 15:1-3. Good morning, Jan.
Good morning, Roland. Good morning, Pastor. You know, I thought about that where Miriam is stricken with leprosy, and it says something about they spoke against Moses' wife, the Cushite. And in that passage it says, and Moses was the most humble man on earth. Was it of all time or just at that time? But, we're talking about Christmas. And I was looking at these passages because as long as we have a commandment of God, that's what we must do.
Right.
And I am unaware of a passage either prohibiting or mandating the creche and the Christmas tree.
Right, exactly.
So when the tradition of men does not depart from the commandment of God, then we have freedom, right?
That's correct.
So, any additional thoughts I didn't address with respect to these passages?
No, and I think for the sake of our readers, I'll read those passages. In Matthew 15:1-3, Pharisees and teachers of the law came to Jesus from Jerusalem and asked them, why do your disciples break the tradition of the elders? They don't wash their hands before they eat. Jesus replied, and why do you break the command of God for the sake of your tradition? So he makes, as you said, he makes the distinction between the commands of God and tradition. And then Mark 7:8 is, you have let go of the commands of God and are holding on to the traditions of men. In the Lutheran Church, we talk about the freedom that we have in this respect, as we use a Latin term, adiaphora. So that means what God has neither commanded, pro or con, is free. And so these traditions of the church, that's why we use the word traditions in the Lutheran Church, we indicate that they are, you may use them, you don't have to use them, you may not use them if you please. And then the rule that the Lutheran Church uses in its corporate setting as a church is the rule of love is to be followed, so that you don't want to use traditions that will cause a great offense or divisions in the church or anything like that. If a congregation has a long-standing tradition, why change it unless there is something seriously wrong with it? That's generally the way that we Lutherans approach that.
Well, thank you, Pastor.
Thanks. Have a blessed Christmas, Jan. Good to hear from you. All the best. Let's grab a quick call from James. James, good morning. You're up next with Dr. Noland.
Good morning, brother.
Morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Pastor. I'm starting to read a book by Adam Taylor called The Mobilizing of Hope, Faith-Inspired Activism for a Post-Civil Rights Generation. And I'd like to know if you know anything about Adam Taylor and who are the Sojourners. Can you tell me a little bit about the history of the Sojourners. And I'll hang up and listen, Pastor.
Yeah, I think the Sojourner even makes an appearance at the end of Joshua chapter 9 as the law is read out.
Oh, did he say Sojourner or So?
The Sojourners.
Maybe you have to explain that to me.
The wanderers, I guess. The people that wander through the land.
Oh, those folks.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Hang on for a second. Hey, let's hang on, James.
I'm sorry.
You're still there. I just potted you back up. Say, raise that again.
Well, the Sojourners as an organization, there is an organization of Christians.
Okay.
Who call themselves Sojourners.
Okay.
And so I was wondering if the pastor knew anything about Adam Taylor and the book, The Mobilizing of Hope, and the organization.
All right. Now I got you, James. Okay, thanks. Yeah, Sojourners is a sort of a left-of-center social justice, new wave, new church type organization. I can picture the guy's face, but I cannot think of his name, who is the commentator that's in the news quite a bit from Sojourners.
What was his name?
I'll look that up real quick.
Are you talking about the magazine? That's how I know about it.
I think there is a magazine along with that.
Jim Wallace?
Yeah, that's it, Jim Wallace. That's
Jim
the guy.
Wallace, Richard Vigory, a couple others. And they would, what would happen with them, if that's who James is talking about, is that the fundamentalists came out of their closet, as it were, in the 1950s. One of the leaders of this was Harold Okinga in Boston. And let's see, Carl F. Henry, who was one of the founders of Christianity Today. One of the early intellectual leaders became prominent in the 1960s was Francis Schaeffer. And these people tended to be politically conservative. And the Sojourners were people that had, at least they claimed at that time, to have a conservative biblical view of things. And so they would be traditionally identified by journalists with fundamentalists. But in terms of political or social issues, they would have a more liberal or moderate view of things. And so Jim Wallace and Richard Vigory, I believe their magazine and their work came into existence in the early 1970s. That's when I first saw it, anyway. And now I really don't, I haven't seen their magazine for years. I don't know where they stand politically. I just know that they often want to say, hey, there's this this more progressive or liberal view among the evangelicals, and they kind of represent it. That's what I know about it.
Vigory, I think, has still stayed right of center, at least from some of the e-blasts that I got from places during the campaign. You know, when you work for a radio station that has a Christian orientation, you get all kinds of junk sent to you.
I'm sure.
And Jim Wallace and Sojourner sent quite a bit. And from what I've read, my understanding, and I could stand to be corrected on this, is that they, as you point out, tend to side more with the progressive side of things, that Jesus as the social justice, social activist savior. Yes, he came to save man, but we have to make this world a better place. And that's not to dismiss that, but perhaps they put too much of an emphasis on the government accomplishing those ends than individual Christians.
Yeah, and you could also say, you know, it's probably a reaction to the over-politicization of the evangelicals. You know, I've read...
Yeah, you're right, yeah.
I've read everything that Francis... Whoops, I'm losing my... Hold on, still there? Okay.
There's only 30 seconds, don't worry about it.
Frankie Schaeffer has reacted against that, and he pretty much has denounced his father, and which is really too bad, but I think what happened with Frankie is that he ran into the politicals that took over the evangelical movement, and so you can see why people like this would react in this way.
Yeah, we've read some of Frankie Schaeffer's articles on the air, where he calls a lot of things into question. Doesn't seem very orthodox, and we've had some discussions about those. You're spot on. But the other fellow, the other name that was mentioned, I've not heard that. But if the writing goes along, what I've read going through the political campaign of the last year, and probably not untypical of Jim Wallace.
Yeah, it's Jim Wallace gives the forward to that, so that explains why there's a connection there.
The Reverend Dr. Martin Nolan serves at Trinity Lutheran Church in Evansville, Indiana, our guest. Last guest of 2012. Thank you, my friend.
Blessed Christmas to all of you.
You as well. Guys, have a great, wonderful Christmas. We've got Bible study programs lined up for you next week. We're back on the 2nd. See you then.
Listen to the Bible study Monday through Friday at this same time. The Bible study is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for the Bible study to continue. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the web at kfuo.org. Download archives at kfuo.org. The Bible study is heard weekdays on KFUO Radio, a broadcast ministry of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod.